This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Friday, time for our week in review, so let's dive right in, starting with the largest tech deal ever, the planned sale of EMC, the state's fourth largest company, to Dell for $67 billion.
Some tech industry veterans like Jim Kingdon, who worked at Data General and other tech firms, are worried about what the sale means for the company's almost 10,000 Massachusetts employees.
I think when you merge two companies together this size, you have redundancy. When you have redundancy, people are going to end up losing their jobs. And that's what happened. It's happening everywhere.
But David Goulden, a top executive at EMC, told us this week that the deal is good news for the Bay State.
It means as we grow, there'll be more jobs in total in Massachusetts. Growth creates jobs. We plan to grow this business, and we plan to have more employees than we have today over time.
But there are even bigger questions about what the sale means for the health and competitiveness of the Massachusetts tech industry overall.
Joining us in the studio to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is John Carroll. He's a professor of communication at BU and a WBUR senior news analyst. John, always good to have you.
Always good to be here.
Also with us is Joan Vinocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan, thanks so much for coming in.
Nice to be here.
So first of all, let's just start with the EMC Dell deal. Your reactions, Joan?
Well, I'm not an expert on the tech sector, but I will say that it sounds like a really big deal that could have really big consequences for Massachusetts, depending on who you want to believe. They say as long as they grow, there'll be more jobs. I guess it depends on them growing as they plan.
Yeah. John?
Yeah, I think there are some people who are really concerned about this. There was a poll of about almost 500 of EMC's customers, and 42% said, you know, this doesn't align with the goals of our organization. And 30% said, we're worried that this is going to be a big distraction. That's one thing. There's a whole Rube Goldberg-esque stock thing, financial structure going on here that has a lot of people concerned and some unhappy. And then the third thing is, this is a horizontal integration of two companies that are going for a bigger share of a stagnant market. And I think that's probably the biggest problem with the deal.
Right. The stuff versus services problem that the industry is moving towards, providing services rather than providing servers and things like that, which EMC does.
Exactly. Cloud computing. I mean, one analyst said Dell and EMC are in the candlestick business, while Google and other people have moved on to light bulbs.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little bit from Glenn O'Donnell, who's a former EMC employee. He told WBUR this week that this deal really signals the end of an era in Massachusetts and that it's part of an overall trend that the state is losing tech giants and has been over the years.
It's bigger than just one company leaving. Policymakers have to examine this and ask, why would businesses be moving away from a place like Boston, once considered one of the technology centers of the world with the 128 corridor and all the technology companies that were there? It's a far different scenario now.
And Joan, let me ask you, I take your point that you're not an expert in the tech sector, but in terms of the way the economy has shifted in Massachusetts, this does seem, as Glenn O'Donnell said, like kind of at the end of an era, because EMC was a giant.
Well, I've read some of the analysis that said it's part of the problem is the non-compete clauses that EMC required that places like California don't, and there's a push to get those changes. And again, but I don't think you can stop this, and I don't know that alone would change it. Look, we were the banking capital. Banks merge and move out. We were a department store capital. The stores merged, and it's the picture changes. I mean, that's all. The economy is about change, and so with the tech sector as well.
Yeah.
Anybody who's talking about the 128 factor here and history of Boston as a tech center is living in the Wayback Machine. I mean, Boston hasn't been
since Wang, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're not probably even in the top 10 at this point. So those glory days are over, and I think that the companies here have to realign themselves to line up with reality at this point. The reality is they need a shift in their perspective. They need a shift in how they deal with things like non-compete so that they have a healthier environment, a healthier startup environment.
All right, well, let's move on and talk about news this week that the Entergy Corporation will shut down the Pilgrim nuclear plant in Plymouth by 2019. After the feds downgraded its safety rating, the plant was facing some costly safety upgrades. But here's Entergy President Bill Mole, who says a glut of cheap natural gas was the main reason behind the decision to close.
This has resulted in significantly lower power prices And from a big picture perspective, we have seen current and forecasted prices drop over $10 a megawatt hour. To put this in perspective, this means a loss of revenues of over $40 million annually for the Pilgrim facility. This is the key driver for our decision.
So the key driver there, John, what does the loss of the Pilgrim nuclear plant mean for the state's overall energy picture?
Well, according to the reports, 84% of the state's environmental or non-carbon emitting energy comes from Pilgrim.
Right.
So that's a big hit to the to sort of the green factor that that Massachusetts is chasing. And I think that they supply a small amount of the overall power.
About 5%, I think, is the figure I saw.
Right, yeah. but a disproportionate amount to clean energy. And I think that's the biggest loss. But I'm not sure it balances out with the safety factor. There are a lot of people concerned about the safety of this. Staying online possibly until 2019. That's a long time to limp along with a nuclear power reactor that has real serious problems.
It was downgraded. It's got the lowest safety rating in the U.S. Now, pro-nuclear people will tell you that doesn't mean it's unsafe. It just means that in the continuum of safety, it's at the bottom end of the safety.
Well, I feel better about that.
Okay, I hope I managed to make you feel better. Joan, what's your response? How does this affect the overall?
Well, there are also jobs, right? There are something like 600 jobs. But, this whole thing about safety, for years, people have been worried about the safety of this power plant. And what they're now basically saying is that it's about money. Money is forcing them to close down, really, not all these concerns about safety. Last spring, I happened to be at the State House when a group of activists marched from Plymouth to the State House. They literally marched the highway. They didn't get that much press except in the Cape Cod papers. So for a long time, people have been trying to raise awareness about it. And I think they should be concerned that it's still going to be open until 2019.
And then when they eventually start the decommission process, that can take up to 60 years to complete. There's still no place to put all the nuclear waste because the feds haven't figured that one out yet. So all those spent fuel rods remain on the site. So, yeah. I mean, talk about safety issues there, John.
Yeah, it's interesting that where they store permanently store the fuel rods is in something called a casket, which is not really encouraging in terms of the future. Some of these are going to be 200 yards away from the shoreline, and I think that this is a bigger ongoing concern. Once they shut the power plant down, what's going to happen with all that really radioactive material, and do they have safe procedures in place to deal with it? I mean, the federal government's going to be all over this, I think, but even so, there's real cause for concern that this could have long-lasting potential effects on Massachusetts.
Yeah, now the shutdown of Pilgrim follows the shutdown of Vermont Yankee last year, Yankee Row in western Massachusetts before that, and all of which suggests that this is sort of a tough time for the nuclear power industry. But we spoke to Michael Golay, a professor of nuclear science and engineering at MIT, who said this week that if we want to combat climate change, nuclear needs to be in the mix. Here's what he said.
If society decides they want reliable, practical solutions that are going to be available with high probability, they'll probably want a mix. And if that were to happen, then nuclear would probably play an important role.
Now, John, we've been talking about safety concerns, what to do with the waste. That remains a problem. But does the need to have, essentially clean power, counterbalance those other concerns?
Well, they kind of have a PR problem, I think. Nuclear has always had a PR problem, and after Fukushima, they had an even bigger PR problem. And their whole attitude has been sort of pay no attention, everything's fine, don't worry about it. And again, there were a lot of people who were worried about it. At that rally that I mentioned a few minutes ago, Michael Dukakis was there. He seems to be everywhere nowadays. I mean, there have been people that are concerned about this a long time, and I suppose they can make the case that we need clean energy and this is the way to get it, but they still have a sales job.
Yeah, I mean, that PR problem stems from the fact that when things do go wrong in a nuclear plant, they go wrong in a really, really bad, big way. Well, let's move on, if we can, to kind of another very serious story this week, and that is the push in Massachusetts to reform rules on solitary confinement in Massachusetts prisons. This is just one of three states that allows the use of long-term solitary confinement up to 10 years in some cases, and a bill currently on Beacon Hill is seeking to make significant changes to that. So I want to play a little bit of tape here, because yesterday we spoke with Donnell Wright. He was arrested for a nonviolent drug offense, and he ended up in solitary confinement for several months at the Worcester House of Corrections before he even went to trial. And here's what he described solitary was like.
There's no outside contact. As a matter of fact, my family didn't even know where I was, and they wouldn't let them know where I was because, as they explained, letting them know where I was would be a security risk. They just throw you in a hole and hide you away from everyone. They can basically do whatever they want to you with impunity.
John, let me start with you because, you know, we love to give ourselves a pat on the back in Massachusetts for being so progressive, but we're one of three states that allows people to be put in a hole, essentially, for 10 years.
Yeah, that's pretty regressive, actually. And I think that some of the reforms that are being talked about are good steps. They would prohibit this solitary confinement for anyone under the age of 21, for pregnant women, which seems like a no-brainer, for the mentally ill. For the deaf and blind, that's all good. You know, the vulnerable populations that are in prison. But everybody who goes into solitary confinement is vulnerable. And I think that the extreme conditions that they have to endure in solitary confinement is something that is cruel and unusual on the face of it. And I think that to change that, because it's an easy way to deal with disciplinary problems, it's an easy way to set an example for people, it's an easy way to try to maintain order, but it's not a humane way to do it. And I think that some culture change would have to take place in the criminal justice system for this to have real reform, real effects.
Well, we may be starting to see that culture change around the country, because California used to allow it up to 20 years, but a class action lawsuit there recently effectively brought that to an end. For now, I mean, President Obama over the summer called for a Justice Department review of the use of solitary confinement. Joan, but I should say that, you know, we reached out to the Department of Corrections this week, and they said, look, we've got good reasons for doing this. It protects prison employees, it protects other prisoners, sometimes it even protects, you know, prisoners from being the targets of gang violence in the prison. So they have their set of reasons. But what do you, Joan, what do you make of the fact that there does seem to be the inklings of some reform on the use of solitary, not just in Massachusetts, but maybe across the country?
Well, I'd say that's great. And who knew that we were one of three that, you know, that fell into this category? And sort of shame on sort of the media for not really knowing what's going on. And again, as you pointed out, it's an example, again, of where we have this image of being liberal and progressive, and the reality is really quite different. Obama actually went to a federal prison, if I recall.
That's right.
I think the first president who's ever done that.
Yep.
And then there's the Francis effect. The Pope did that as well. And I think that those are good things, and we should be paying attention to it here in Massachusetts.
We incarcerate more than any other advanced nation in this country, so definitely an issue worth paying attention to. Finally, let's move on to Governor Baker's proposed legislation to combat the opioid addiction crisis. Among other things, he wants to give hospitals the ability to hold drug abusers against their will for up to 3 days. If they are deemed a danger to themselves. He also wants to require that doctors give first-time patients just 72 hours worth of opiate medication, no more. Here's the governor speaking about this.
I and many others have listened to far too many stories of people who come home from the doctor's office, the dentist, or the hospital with 30, 40, 50, 60, 80 tabs of all kinds of opioids. When a handful would do. This has got to stop.
So, Joan, more than 100 opiate deaths so far this year in the state. What do you think of the governor's proposed measures here?
Well, he sounds and seems very passionate about it, and I say I think he's on the right track. Good luck to him going up against the doctors, though. They're not going to give up on this easily. I did some research for Globe editorial I wrote a few months ago, and they are dogged advocates for sort of saying that they know what they're doing. The problem isn't the prescriptions, it's that people who get prescriptions leave them in their medical cabinets for other people to get. But if they didn't write the prescriptions in the first place, they wouldn't be there. But I think Baker's doing the right thing here.
Well, to that point, there is some pushback, as you suggested. Here's Dr. David Lustbader of the Massachusetts Dental Society. He says 3 days' worth of pills isn't enough for many patients.
People that are going to truly need pain medication are going to end up without it. And that's not fair to anybody. And that's really unethical to let somebody suffer.
So, John, what do you think's going on here?
Well, I think that people are protecting their turf and people are protecting their personal financial interests. But the truth of the matter is people with chronic pain, people with hospice care who are in hospice care, they're exempted from this law. So this law is specifically targeted at people who pretty much need short-term pain relief, and that's why it's 72 hours. I mean, the numbers are staggering. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population, and we consume 80% of the opioids in the world. It's beyond belief. There were 4.5 million prescriptions written last year. So I think that the Mass Medical Association has taken an interesting position because they're talking about the traditional physician-patient relationship for one thing, but they're also talking about this idea of Baker's that you could detain a drug abuser for 72 hours if you think he's dangerous to himself or to others. A law that exists now for mentally ill people, the Mass Medical Association is fighting that aspect of it too, which you would think would be the province of the ACLU more than them. But they're going after it on both from both angles. So I think that shows how serious they are in terms of trying to stop this movement.
Yeah, and to that point, let's listen to Dr. Dennis Dimitri of the Massachusetts Medical Society speaking to WBUR's Bob Oakes earlier today. Here's what he said about that.
If we start to see large numbers of people being put into 72-hour involuntary commitments for addiction therapy, where are we going to do that? We know that oftentimes if you try to force patients into treatment for any kind of medical problem, that can be not really an effective means of medical therapy.
So there's that concern. There's also a shortage of beds, Joan. I mean, some of the folks in the emergency rooms are saying this will just shut the emergency room system down, flat, cold.
Right. I guess my personal reaction is I have more of a problem with the idea of detaining people against their will, even if it's for the greater good, than I do with limiting the prescription to 72 hours. I mean, I think it's a case-by-case basis. If you go to the dentist and you have some sort of oral surgery, it seems like 3 days is more than enough to get you over the hump of any pain you would have. And as John pointed out, in other situations, there are exemptions. So I think the medical society is just trying to glom onto the whole thing because they just don't want anybody taking control from them.
Mm. Well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs, and those are those stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the newscast, as we say. So, Joan, you're up first. What's your hubbub?
Well, I am going to talk about the Mets versus the Cubs. And since this is Boston, it's not at the top of anybody's headline right now.
I like the Mets.
A lot of people in Boston do seem to be rooting for the Cubs because of Theo Epstein and John Lester and all that. But this is a little bit sentimental. I grew up on Long Island. My dad was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan who had his heart broken, and then he became a Mets fan, took me to Mets games. We went on the Long Island Railroad. He bought me potato knishes. You can't get that around here. And I was sitting with him when the ball went through Buckner's legs in 1986. So
you were there in Shea?
No, not at the ballpark. We were watching it on TV together. And at the time, I was rooting for the Red Sox. At any rate, not to get overly sentimental, but he died 2 years ago, so I'm rooting for the Mets in his memory.
All right.
That's sweet. That's sweet.
Well, I'm going to root for the Mets just for that reason. I'm going to join you.
John, your hubbub?
Well, Tom Brady caused a bit of a kerfuffle down in New York the other night. According to the always reliable New York Post Page Six, he was slated to show up at a publicity event for some new fancy schmancy watch that he's endorsing, and he was an hour late, according to one of their sources, which went over like the metric system, and 11 photographers stormed out of the event. And I just want to read you two quotes that are really revelatory. The source said, "It was a tremendous act of solidarity that that only begins to address the sometimes inhumane ways professionals are treated. This is the paparazzi talking, right? So that's one thing. And here's the other thing that they said. You think there's people in France talking about Tom Brady? He's not George Clooney. He doesn't have an acting career. He's not even Shia LaBeouf. If you want to see him, flip to your sports section. He's there throwing footballs. That's really mean, the Shia LaBeouf thing.
I know, that's a low blow.
That is really mean. So I'm hoping that that Tom gets more timely so he doesn't have to suffer attacks like this anymore.
They haven't seen his UGG ads.
Apparently he's not Shia LaBeouf for sure. He's like twice as tall as Shia LaBeouf to begin with. Anthony, are you going next or am I?
All right, I'll go next. Okay. So MyHubBub is an appeal for better roads for bicycle safety in Greater Boston, which is something we've talked about a bunch on this show. There's a lot of talk about this. Some progress, but filmmaker Jeff Adams of Newton posted a great YouTube video of his ride from Newton to Cambridge. BostonGlobe.com picked this up. It's also on YouTube, which takes him through three dramatically unsafe intersections. So he's biking along the Charles. It takes him across major arteries and intersections where there are no crossing signals at all. None. He has to wait, watch, and then run the gauntlet and hope for the best. So here's a clip describing the crossing of North Beacon Street and Nonantum Road in Brighton.
I have watched pedestrians and cyclists arrive here astounded, confused, and in total disbelief at the insanity of this crossing. The path was constructed in the early 1980s. Have these crossings been like this for 30 years? Why are these crossings just left in such an unsafe condition?
It's a great question, and I encounter something similar on my commute from East Somerville under the McGrath-O'Brien Highway. It's an automotive battlefield under there with no way to get through. So this is my appeal to city officials across Greater Boston. People are dying. We know how to fix this. Let's fix it.
Absolutely. And that crossing that he was talking about in the video is horrible.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
I mean, and he wonders if it's been like that since the 80s, more like the 1880s. It is so bad there. Okay, well, I'm going to end on a little bit of a lighter note. And it's funny because we're supposed to do these hubbubs that don't appear on the front page, but this was on the front page of the Globe today. There is a cockatoo apparently terrorizing the toniest, quote-unquote, toniest sections of Brookline. And one person who lives in that section is a friend of Radio Boston, retired judge Nancy Gertner, whom we love. Judge Gertner, if you're listening to this, please take this in the right way. So this cockatoo is his name's Dino, and he's pecking away at Judge Gertner's house, and Judge Gertner's tried everything under the sun to get the cockatoo to stop, trying to feed him, trying to trap him. Then she upped the ante and blared rock music and an alarm and a car alarm or some kind of alarm along the lines of what the United States military did to try and oust Manuel Noriega. That's what it sounded like to me. But nothing has worked so far. So if any Radio Boston listener out there knows of a humane way to trap a raging white cockatoo, I think I know a federal judge who would love to have some help. So that is my hubbub.
All right. John Carroll is a professor of communication at BU and a senior news analyst here at WBUR. John, thanks. Have
Thank
a great
you.
Weekend.
You too.
And Joan Vinocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to have you. Have a great weekend and go Mets.
Thank you.
Well, stay with us. When we come back, we'll talk to the accidental father of fantasy sports. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.